You are listening to Yadda Chat, a podcast produced by Yadda Yadda Noise.
And hosted by Alice Godber, who's currently studying an MA in creative practice at Hull College.
And Lucy Francis, who will come at the show from the education sector around the arts.
This podcast will interview Hull creatives and talk about our local industry.
The aim of this is to try and capture the wave of frustration the creative sector is going through, whilst also looking at some of the positives that might have come from these recent months. Hello, welcome to episode 4 of Yadda Chat. We are joined by Sally Witts. Hi, Sally.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah, in these crazy days.
It's been a wild week or two, I can tell you that. So, Sally, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do.
In a nutshell, I guess the label on the tin would be creative, I guess. I'm a creative, but that could mean all sorts. I'm a mum, first and foremost, and I don't think there's any shame in saying that. I think that's the best job in the whole world.
And the hardest.
and the hardest, absolutely. Yeah. It's like a conundrum, a challenge, but it's cool. It's not without rewards. But yeah, I act. I direct, I teach, and I write. Yeah, as long as I'm doing something creative that helps me to get what's in here out and maybe share that with others, then I'm happy.
So you also run the group Calmsea Creatives as well.
Yeah.
I've seen bits of it on social media and Facebook and stuff, but tell us about it.
Excellent, I'd love to. I spent ages trying, you know, before I had my children, as somebody who came to Hull to do my degree too many years ago, to get involved and engage and be creative. And any creative likes to meet like-minded creatives and talk about things and create, collaborate. And I, after years of being on the boards of theatre companies, I was on the board of Hull Truck Theatre for about 7 or 8 years and helping out with different drama companies and amateur companies, I thought, you know, I really want to make use of the skills that I learned on my master's and help support other artists and also try and see which areas I could push my own creativity in. So aside from my life as a teacher and my life as an actor, I'm one of these people who thought, you know what, I've got a spare 7 hours a day that I'm only sleeping in. So why not do something to kind of push the boundaries and see what else is possible? So I'm lucky enough to know lots of people who are of the same mindset, and it is a massive privilege to kind of have the opportunity to chat ideas through with these people. And two of them are Charlotte Bogatinova, who's an artist who used to be involved in the Red Gallery. I don't know if you recall the Red Gallery. And also an up-and-coming theatre writer called Joseph Boff, who's quite local. And we got together and decided that it would be really lovely to get something, an organisation together to support young people in this area. Then we thought, why stop at young people? Why not try and facilitate the need for everybody to try and engage in something creative without any barriers, without the barrier of their postcode or how affluent their family or their home situation may or may not be. So we devised a business plan for a company called Hull Extra Tuition Company. And as an umbrella organisation, we devised the concept of Calmsea Creatives. So we're really, really excited because we just got started. We'd had like a year of planning and we just got started with 6 months of workshops and productions and rehearsals. And then lovely COVID-19 entered our lives. But we've kept it going, you know, through to the wonder of technology. We've managed to maintain our rehearsals and our youth groups and our one-to-one mentoring. And our plan is very much still in place. So we look forward to Calmsea Creative Adventures in the future.
And the participants that are engaging with that at the moment, are they from lots of different areas across Hull area only or wider?
Yeah, we used something called the Data Observatory. I don't know if you're familiar with that, which shows the postcodes within Hull. I mean, my background as somebody who produces film and theatre on a freelance basis means that, you know, you'll understand yourselves the process of bid writing. Sometimes it's really helpful and informative to look at the data surrounding where the need is, and that need quite often comes from how affluent a particular area is or where the need is in terms of arts engagement. And looking at the the data for HU postcodes, particularly as our starting point, and looking at triangulating that with also schools data and also data from the whole 2017 surveys that's freely available. We really thought there's so many young people and children living in areas where, you know, if there is arts provision for them, they're unlikely to be able to regularly participate in that owing to the cost. So we just felt there was a huge need to work in those postcode areas, Springbank being one of our areas of huge concern, but also further afield as well, heading out towards the boundary with the East Riding. You know, it's not such a clear cut case as a particular postcode area or a particular street in Hull with that need for people of all ages and all backgrounds. So we just felt that a community interest company was the way to go. So an organisation where we can purely focus our attentions on trying to connect people who have the time and the expertise with young people or people from different backgrounds of all ages who can be inspired by that expertise. We thought that was a positive thing, especially in today's world, which is so changeable and so kind of different on a daily basis, isn't it?
So how are they accessing that at the moment then? Is it online workshops and...
Yeah, I mean, our production at the moment is we've got three things in the running, the first of which is a production called Futility of Youth, which was a production written by Joseph Off. And it kind of drew together young people from a variety of backgrounds to work on a production that was mainly monologue based. It was black box theatre in format, and really was great because it got them considering how they could write, how they could interpret, how they could shape their own character and their own role. And I think there needs to be more of that. It's great to give a kid a script and say, learn your lines, you know, let's learn this dance routine, and there's a place for that, and that's joyous and wonderful and great. But there's also a really lovely part to play in letting a child play around with some language and a character and a role, and then enjoy that chemistry where they see what another student has done with their role, and then combining that and building it and snowballing it. And luckily, all the young people who are participants were happy to transfer that onto an online basis. So we've been working one-to-one with them through obviously internet platforms to coach and rehearse and talk through and discuss. So although there's no tour as planned this Easter, a Futility of Youth, we do really have our sights set on some kind of an online representation of that project. Brilliant. And part of the inspiration for that is the young people, because if ever you need somebody to kind of focus you and pat you on the back, you know, like a boxer's coach in the ring, it will always be the young people. They've got a huge belief in technology. And I think it's lovely to see how that's inspired lots of organisations to keep going and embrace that new learning and that new way of working.
What kind of ages are they, Sally?
Okay, we go from we're not exclusive in terms of age, but the current cast for Futility of Youth goes from the age of 10 to the age of 19, which is great. But I'm excited also about our other project, which is a play about dementia, and it's called H. And I've got the good fortune to write with a really lovely senior writer called Christine Park, who's just fantastic. And she and I are collaborating on a story to tell the life journey of her partner, Harry, who recently passed, sadly. She was very, very keen to explore his life and the twists and turns of him being a rockabilly in the 50s and 60s and where his life led him up to, you know, his final days, in which sadly he suffered from dementia. So we really feel that would be a great community focus to have a cast of all ages and start working on that now via the internet. So it's interesting, isn't it, the way that if you really want a project to work, there's always a solution. You just have to kind of see the opportunity there. So that's what's next in the pot.
These kind of projects, I suppose, you know, I haven't done them for a while, but certainly writing, and I know Alice is doing working with me on a project that we're doing in the college at the moment alongside the City Healthcare Partnership. But it's writing and kind of directing and acting and all those things can still exist in this new format, can't they? But the thing that's difficult then thereafter is the consumption of that work.
That's where
it's really difficult, isn't it?
It's completely. And I think so much of the magic of theatre and writing and performance, it's connection, isn't it? It's connecting with your audience. And so much of that is reading their their facial expressions. You know, you, as a performer, you feed from the energy an audience gives you. You learn to read that. Even when you're in role, you learn to read each facial expression, each gasp, each changing of the posture in their chair as a measure of how they're taking in your character, your story, this reality that you're portraying to them, or representation of such on stage. And it is very hard, you know, talking to a screen, performing to this little tiny dot of a camera. But, you know, it's something that I think you have to look around and see how people who are very experienced and very worldly wise are responding. And somebody I've taken a great amount of influence from is somebody called Jeremy Goldstein, who's an Australian theatre producer who is London and Australia based. He had a production called Truth to Power Cafe. It visited Hull Minster in the 2017 year. And it's such a great project. His project Truth to Power invites local people of any one show to contribute their ideas as to who or what has power over them and what would they like to say to that person or thing that has power over them. Such a powerful concept. Mm. And he's toured with that. And he was just getting to the stage where he was building a massive multinational audience, this great thing that was building, this sociodrama, and then COVID happened. So I was interested to see what happened with that project. And true to Jeremy, he always sees a way out of things, and he took it online, and now he's a finalist at the moment for the Innovation Award for the Offies, which is just great.
Brilliant.
He just took it all online, and as long as his secret, I think, is he's got such a strong bond, like directly with the participants of his shows and with the audience of his shows, he takes time to get to know them, gets to know the demographic, gets to know what the message is and how that might be received in different ways, and takes time to consider the process. And that has continued and gone from strength to strength with lack of person-to-person contact. You know, it's not been a barrier to him. So, yeah, I think if we can all find examples locally, nationally, internationally of people who have stepped back and seen the opportunity and then sought to make this work on whatever budget, then I think that's half the remedy.
Interestingly, obviously, your work is working as well around students or young people who are, you know, classed as, I suppose, disadvantaged or not as affluent in certain areas and things. And obviously that those, you know, I've worked a lot in kind of access to arts over the years that I've been a teacher. And I think one of the key things about now and this kind of online world is that actually we will see, hopefully, an increase of that participation with things like theatre arts online. Because even now, and will always, I would imagine, still exist this kind of, I suppose, like an elitism that doesn't really exist, but there is this kind of idea that theatre is elitist, or that fine art is elitist, or that there's a certain, unfortunately, still that idea in some circles, in some young people, that, oh, well, no, I don't go to the theatre, or I don't go to art galleries.
Yeah.
And once, obviously, they meet the right teacher or they go to the right institute, they get shown how accessible those things are, then that changes quite quickly. But for lots of young people, it doesn't. And so to have something that is online and accessible for young people so they can start to see something that potentially they wouldn't have maybe gone to the theatre to see, that's really positive as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think one of my favourite books is The Empty Space by Peter Brook. You know, the way he opens it by saying, forgive me for misquoting, but he says something along the lines of, all that needs to happen for a piece of theatre to take place is for a man to walk into an empty space. And I think when you start from that concept, it becomes quite important, I think, that the initial starting point is to just dispel any preconceptions of theatre as being red velvet and, you know, footlights and this grand routine of turning up in all your finery. Theatre's the guy having a fight at the bus stop, or the woman having a chat with a mate on the bus that you overhear, you know. Theatre's everywhere. And I think once you manage to break down that preconception with young people, they start to have a lot of fun with it. And that, isn't that just a joy to see when they start realizing? It's the same kind of joy you see with, like, my youngest daughter, Ada. She's 4, and she'll come down and say something like, you're not my mama today, you are broken heart Gladys. I'm like, okay, I can do that role. I'll make your tea whilst being brokenhearted, Gladys. And it's this whole idea that she's experimenting with characters and how she can direct and how she, that's a little bit of creative control. And I think if you can remind children of that, because they all have it, all children have that instinct when they're tiny, you know, no matter what their background, they all have that little capacity for make-believe. It's just masked. It's all there somewhere.
My four-year-old boy generally tells me that I'm a bum face. I think that's a slightly less a cultured approach to characterization, and I'm yet to really appreciate how I will become bum face. I will always try.
Very alpha Jerry, isn't it? It's very kind of
yeah. I think I'll continue to try and take that on in some realms, but I mean, maybe bum face is a different character every day in his mind, so it's tricky.
Do you know what? I think you have a concept there for a show. We should get together and write this later.
We should.
Definitely.
Let our four-year-olds direct it.
Yeah. I do think that's great though. One thing that I got really inspired by was a few years back. Did you see the video clips on the internet of toddler-led dance classes?
No.
Where they got toddlers just to move
that
and respond
incredible.
To music. And then they got professional dancers from top ballet companies to imitate and just kind of free flow mimic the movements of the toddler as the toddler was. So they were being choreographed by the toddlers. Instinctive response to the beat and the tone of the music. I love that. I think there should be more of that.
I love that both my boys love dancing actually. They love music and dancing, and but then I'll say, oh, because they've both got a good rhythm because they take after me. And oh, please, I really want to start you in a dance class. Do you want to start a dance class? And as soon as I say that, particularly my eldest who's seven, he's like, I am not going to a dance class. It's like the worst thing I could possibly say. It's such a shame that even at that age, he's like, in fact, I've just had a conversation earlier about this, about boys and dance, and he's sort of adamant that no, boys don't go to dance class. And I'm like, oh, but they do, and there's some amazing male dancers.
Strange, isn't it, where they pick that label, that kind of ideology up from? Because it's, you know, when you know it's not from a parental setting and it's not from an educational setting, what is it that they're reading from, you know, semiotically in society to get that message? It's an interesting thing to note.
Very interesting. Well, I think obviously it is his peers, it is his class, and not to say that it's their parents. I think that these young people have multiple different kind of influences that we don't see that prescribe that idea of kind of gender specific roles, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I could talk about that for a long time, to be fair. It's one of my major niggles. I literally had a meeting this morning about how we're going to tackle it in the department that I manage, because we've got a real low female uptake of music and a very low male uptake of dance, and obviously that's not reflective of industry and not true of industry, and yet at the education level it's been true for certainly as long as I've known.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to tackle it, don't we?
We do, completely. And I think what's really reassuring is, you know, the viability of the arts, regardless of gender or any aspect of identity or background, is, I've seen that come under the microscope. I don't know if you'd agree with me. I seem to have seen that be more under the lens at the moment during C19. It seems to have, there are certain issues that have been raised about the viability of the arts. You know, when people go, well, what have you done during lockdown? You've watched Netflix, you've read a book, you've engaged with all these free performances from ballet companies and theatre companies, both nationally and internationally, and you're telling us that the arts aren't viable. And I think that message now is starting to come across. I'm not saying, you know, the day will come where people are standing on their doorsteps clapping for actors, because sadly, I don't think, and I think I'm quite grateful for that in a weird way. I don't think that level of dare I say it, insincerity would be helpful, but I do think that there is a bit of a kind of emergence of a new type of respect that might well just inspire, you know, people of all genders, sexualities, identities to pursue what they find of interest. But there's always been barriers, you know, for everybody, regardless of who they are. I mean, I was lucky. I had a dad and stepmother who were incredibly supportive when I did my degree. I'm sure my dad would have loved me to have done a geography degree and master's, because he was a town planner and really respected in his field. But he understood. I was lucky that I had parents who understood that I was creative and I did seek to have a creative career, and they supported that. But I think it's very important, particularly now where opportunities for young people have temporarily almost been curtailed because of the lack of, you know, studio ability to connect in a studio or what have you, just to kind of take that time for to sit and talk with your children, sit down and talk to them about, you know, what it is that their aspiration is and why that is and what the bigger plan is, so that nothing is written off.
And I think we'll find as well that there's lots of young people at the moment in their bedrooms, and the thing that they'll find solace in is their creativity, mostly. Absolutely. Isn't it, in one way or another?
Absolutely. Really. It really, really is. And whether that's, you know, sat down doodling, you know, prospective tattoo designs, or whether that's experimenting with hair and makeup or writing, or I've got the pleasure of teaching a young man in one of the settings in which I work at the moment who is really trying hard with his literacy. But my word, if you put some just like a beat in the background, he will stand up and rhyme and come out with the best kind of grime rhymes, if you like.
Oh, wow.
It's just amazing. These words just kind of flow out and they're in perfect kind of beat, and it's just wonderful to see. And you know, you've got to be so careful, haven't you, because the last thing you want to do is label a child like that the poet guy, or you know, heap loads of praise and make them want to kind of scurry into a corner and throw their poetry away. You've got to be very careful when you nurture that, and when you observe that, and I think in many ways allow young people the space to celebrate that in their own time. But it's so lovely when you see that and then years later see them realize that and be confident enough to go out there and make a success of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one major sort of, I guess, positive of all the lockdowns, I guess, if we can see a positive. It's the fact that we've had a lot more time, and so it's given us an opportunity to either just sort of recharge, or, you know, to either to take something up, or you don't even necessarily have to have taken anything up. It's okay if you've not done anything, because, like, sometimes you just really need it. But I think as well, like, the creativity and stuff and like resilience in people, it's been tested, but the creativity has shone through. Mm. Lots of like lovely things have been like sprouting up in little areas, and it's nice to see. And I think it's sort of, it does show a glimmer of hope for, you know, when hopefully things can start getting back to normal, whenever that may be.
I think the sense of community that times in history draws out from people is really wonderful. It's, I know nobody would have wished for this situation, but it is quite an honour, and it's quite a thing of joy to see the amount of community from little acts of kindness, like people leaving little gifts on your doorstep. Quite, you know, a few of my friends have been leaving little things on their doorstep, particularly during the first lockdown, to kind of bigger acts, like getting together, like at the moment on in the Avenues Fairy Trail, where people are coming together, and the whole teddy bear thing. So it goes from tiny little acts that your household can do that take a few seconds to bigger, more collaborative endeavours. I think it's interesting to see the role creativity has taken in individuals' responses to that. Mm. I think one of my favourite projects I've seen happen during lockdown times has been the doorstep dancers, you know, Tamar and Joe's doorstep dancers. Yeah. They're just so lovely. Like, there was a week I drove around, whizzing around, collecting child A, child B, child C from various schools and what have you. And I just kept seeing them crop up in their wonderful Christmas lights.
Incredible.
Outfits, doing doorstep dances. I was that embarrassing person who wound the window down shouting, "Oi, Tamar and Joe, yeah!" Whoops, there's a car. But no, it's lovely, and it's nice that I do wonder if other communities and other cities have had the same response, because I know this wonderful, wonderful city of Hull and surrounding areas is really great to benefit from that proper community of people, of artists who are eager to connect and share and learn and help each other to grow and to build. It's something that I think is truly a gift of this city. It's just wonderful. And it's been very, very obvious that's come into its own during this time. It's really, really reassuring and lovely for my children to see as well, lovely for younger people to see and be a part of.
Yeah, I know. I think it's lovely. I was thinking the other day about how nice it is to sort of be in this area and see everything, you know, just all the creativity. I mean, when I first joined my degree, my BA, I had no idea what I was like walking into. I had like no idea at all. But then all of a sudden, like, came into Hull, and I was just like, wow, what have I been missing all these years? This is incredible.
Yeah, there's a real community of arts in Hull, and I've obviously, from performing and also being in education and working with different sort of kind of providers and things, there is a kind of real supportive kind of feel in Hull, I think. And I can't compare it, because I've never lived in the art scene in other cities. but I do think it probably is fairly unique. It's not competitive, certainly not aggressively. It's kind of much more everybody wants everybody to do well, and everybody is kind of really egging everyone on to do something great for the city. And, you know, and everybody wants Hull to be seen as a creative city and not just this kind of end of the line kind of place where nothing happens.
Completely. And you know what I think is added to that magic? I mean, I know Sheffield, Manchester and Leeds, they all have their own creative hubs, but what I've noticed and what I love about Hull is it's so intergenerational here. You know, like when I look at friends I know through arts projects, drama, dance, music, all of those projects, it's almost like it never occurs to anybody to consider someone's age when they're inviting into a project. You know, you go to a contemporary dance class and there's people, time-served dancers who are now in their 70s attending. And then there's also people who are, you know, just doing their A-levels. It's great. And it's just part of that kind of rich tapestry. I did a read-through for a great writer called J.K. Smith the other day for a new play that he's writing. And, you know, that's the other thing. Having the time to be able to contribute your time to assist people in things like read-throughs and R&D is just wonderful. But just sat there, you know, going through the read-through on a Saturday night and seeing just where people from different backgrounds, different cities, of different ages, of different levels of experience. It's just so great because I think there's a really lovely richness to projects that involve people from, you know, different generations and walks of life. And I've lived in a few cities, but I've never experienced that as much as I have whilst in Hull.
For me, that's one of the frustrations sometimes when kind of funded arts coordinators or kind of organisations that come in and like we work with the Ferens, we work with Absolutely Cultured and those partnerships are excellent and very fruitful and I'm really pleased that we're able to work with them. However, obviously the funding streams that come through those kind of organisations are very much a lot of the time worked through age or dependent on age, and so they're looking for a certain age bracket to engage with, and they certainly don't exclude those that aren't in the bracket, not by any means, and all of our students still benefit. But it's interesting, really, that somewhere up above there in the government, somebody's saying this fund that we're going to put into the arts, you know, this is just for 14 to 18 year olds or whatever. And you've really got to question, well, why?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's absurd to think that the criteria for awarding funding to ignite and catalyse projects that then will give out to the community, they're focusing too much on the demographic of who's running the project as opposed to the demographic of who's going to be benefiting from the outcome of that project. I think if the attention turns more onto audience and the breadth of audience and how is it going to work, you know, what difference will it make? How will it open people's minds? How will it connect people in community? When that is the focus, then you've got a really well funded, well planned, well backed project. But when funders really pigeonhole who it is that they want to entrust this, you know, this lovely little idea that they've got in their mind that they want to find somebody to carry forth almost, then, you know, it's so blinkered, they're missing such an opportunity, because the best teams have a combination of that freshness of people who are, you know, newly trained, newly qualified and have that, you know, that vibrancy and vitality, and also people who are more experienced and are more time served and do have that wider network. I think, you know, a very rich team, like I said before, is a broad and diverse team. Definitely.
I agree. Yeah. Moving on to a little bit of retraining. So this has gone through every single episode that we've done so far, but I find it really interesting to talk about. The suggestion is that, you know, all us creatives should retrain, ideally in cyber, but although I've not actually met anyone yet who's had it come up like you should actually retrain in cyber. The actual questionnaire, that should be like the first thing that comes up. It should be like, well, one cyber and then here are some other options.
Yeah.
But no, okay. Yes, so Sally, did you do the quiz?
I did the quiz.
Did you?
In my days, it's a good job, isn't it, that I'm not relying on this quiz for the direction of my life. I did the quiz and funnily enough, one of the options it gave me was actor, which I was really chuffed at. Like, there you go.
I got it right.
Creative, they don't know their mind, because this is what you get. The other option was construction, apparently, which I find hilarious.
I can just see you on a construction site.
I'm good with Lego, and I'm kind of good at baking cakes so they don't fall over, and the sugar craft. Is that construction? Does that count?
I'd say that was construction. Yeah, that's construction.
Yeah, and I think libraries, editing and libraries was the other option it gave me, which for anybody who knows how much I gab along and love to talk, love libraries, huge respect. Some of the wisest people in my life are librarians and are very well respected, such as my friend Karen Usher, but I couldn't do it. I'm too messy. I'd be like, Dewey, what? I do that terrible thing where you fold the corner of books over. Like,
I do that.
I know, it's bad, isn't it? And I just talk too much. I distract people while they were trying to study or learn or read. So
I'm a huge distractor. When I was doing my fine art degree, if sort of people weren't working, they just sort of knew. They were like, where's Ellen? And they'd find me, and I'd always sort of attract a group, and then I'd be like, let's all, like, I don't know, how tall is everyone? And just like, just really random stuff. You know, it was fun. I really enjoyed it.
It's great, isn't it? I think all creative people, not exclusively creative people, she says, avoiding a sweeping generalization, but I think a lovely trait of creative people is that they tend to have three narratives going through their brain at any one point. The first one, I think, is kind of practical, like, ooh, do I need a drink? Do I need a snack? Do I need to stand up? Ooh, I could just bust a dance move right now. That would help my brain work. The other one is kind of like, okay, I'm reading this, I'm processing it. I've read the same paragraph four times now and it's still not making sense, so I'll keep reading it. Probably not going in because of the first narrative. And the third narrative is like, oh, I've just had a great idea for a play about a dinosaur, like years in the future, and this random creative spiraling idea. So it's a wonder, isn't it? It's strange that we ever managed to actually achieve anything. But it's a lot of fun trying to kind of keep those three areas of your brain going at the same time.
Yeah. I think creative people are very, very good at procrastination. From my experience, my partner at home, the kid's daddy, and he's a very creative, you know, great in terms of ideas with the kids and stuff like that, but also very, very creative with procrastination. I'll just do this before I do that. And I mean, not that I don't procrastinate. I do. I'm just not as creative at it as he is.
My version of that is, I don't know, well, recently anyway, I've just sort of been on my Xbox loads. Like, I go through, like, massive phases, and I'm like, I've got to finish the game. I'm maybe, like, 60 hours into it.
Wow.
And so I'm just like, I'm never going to get over, I'm never going to finish this. Once I finish it, I'll be able to, like, get back to my work and stuff. Yeah, and I'm finding a lot of my time is just sort of spent now.
Yeah, but think of the creative minds that have made that game. I think that's
why. I do stop and, like, I look at the sunsets in the game, because it's really, they're, like, really good.
That's the magic of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's cool.
Oh, the arts aren't viable, we're going to get a proper career, retrain. It's like, actually, you know, you're playing video games. How many creators did it take to bring that concept to fruition? How many creators on the film that you just watched, on, you know, the piece of clothing you just wore, on the car that you've got your eye on buying or saving up for next? You know, creativity runs through all of these things, not even as a pulse, it's a backbone, it's the very essence of it.
Yeah, even like the adverts that the government bring out, you wouldn't have what you've got there. If it wasn't for us, so I mean, you're welcome.
Yeah, very true.
I mean, if I'm honest, then I don't really rate that questionnaire, just because I'm like still a little bit bitter about it saying that I need to go into horse grooming, and I did it twice as well. It was just like, right.
But we are going to take you, aren't we, for a day of grooming, just to see.
Can we do that? That would be a great podcast. Alice does horse grooming.
Yeah, it can be like after the series, it can be like an extra.
Yeah, I've got a friend with horses. I'm sure she'd give you a bit of training.
Oh, really? That would be great. Alaska. Oh.
See, we have a whole series here. We just each say what our alternative career was, and we go and try that out for a day.
Oh my God, mine is head chef, and I would absolutely love it. I love head cooking.
Yeah,
I absolutely love cooking, but I know, I mean, I'm not bad at cooking, but I'm certainly not like, you know, a head chef. So I would love to go and get trained and do a day with like a really good chef. So
and you also have.
Let's put it on the podcast budget.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. What's a surprising thing on your CV, like job history? What's the most surprising job on your CV?
My most surprising job, probably actually being a teacher, if you look at what I was like at school. I tell you now that my school, the head of my school, when I got my GCSEs, we had to all go into her office and receive our grades. And there was about, I think there was maybe three teachers there. And they all just had a look of absolute shock on their faces. And they were like, well, we just can't believe that you've managed to achieve these grades. And I was like, really, really? And they gave me my grades and I got like an A and 5 B's and 3 C's.
I hope you strutted out of there. I hope you kind of gave them the
I was just like,
glare hair toss.
And they were just like, we just can't believe it. And I was like, neither can I. And yeah, I know for a fact, if I was to tell any of the teachers that I went to school with that I became a teacher and a head of department, I think they'd still be like looking around my history going, where did she cheat? And she must have cheated to get to this point.
Yeah, looking through all the papers. Like,
yeah, this can't be true. Definitely. So I'd say that in terms of who I've been educated by, I'd say that was probably my most surprising and longest lasting career that I've had thus far.
That's great, though. I love that. The idea of who people may have perceived you to be in the past, and then you've gone on through your experiences and your career and your endeavours, and it's just completely mismatched their expectations of you. I love that. I think that's more of that to be had in life, I think.
That's what we want for all young people, isn't it? You don't want
Absolutely.
Really, there's not a single young person sat out there right now who couldn't achieve anything they wanted to.
Absolutely. It's never too late.
No, completely. I mean, I remember when I think I was in year 9 or something and I got diagnosed with APD, auditory processing disorder. And then it was just, no one really sort of knew what it was, but it made sense because like all throughout primary school and stuff, just like taking me to different doctors and like ear doctors and whatever. But it took until, year 9 and... Well, the whole thing of it is it's the processing of what you hear. Doing what I have been doing recently, especially this year and last year, with like I learned how to edit audio and like I've made some radio shows and just, well, I mean, it just sort of completely goes against what I was sort of told that I wouldn't be able to do. And I guess, I don't know, I think the struggling has made me work harder. I think a lot of it comes down to who I've had around me, I guess, like support and just being inspired. I feel bad like patting myself on the back.
You shouldn't, that's so British. Yeah,
exactly. Definitely.
The only reason why I brought up was because when there was the inauguration of Biden, the girl who did the poetry and spoken word, she actually has APD. And so on all of these groups that I'm sort of like in, it's just been articles and articles about it. But I was just like, wow, like that's just incredible. And it does show that it can be done a bit like me with sort of learning to do all this stuff that I never thought I'd be able to. Just really working really hard. And I guess like slowly, it takes a bit longer, but you can get there.
Well, I mean, editing is like, it's all absolutely, well, editing a podcast is all absolutely dependent on that auditory processing and then you putting it together and stitching it all together so it's still linear. I mean, that's incredible that you're doing that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, because I don't really notice that I do it because it's something that I've always done, but I lip read a little bit. And so, to be fair with the audio, I've learned, I know what certain words look like, so I can just see it. And I'm just like, right, I bet you that's what that word is. And
it's like learning a language, isn't it? Seeing the visual presentation on the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, my first experience was audio. I did a... In 1994, I came to Hull and did a degree in media communications called Communication Processes. And now as somebody who I've learned that a lot of the people I've come into contact with in Hull creatively, in a creative capacity, used to lecture on that course. Mm. But I only met them quite recently. So it's interesting how these things, like we say, go full circle.
Yeah.
I majored in radio and we had my friends and I on the course had a radio station that we used to transmit from the Inglemeyer Avenue campus of the University of Humberside, which is no more. It's now a housing estate. And we had a lot of fun interviewing bands in the Adelphi and at the Welly and in the Room and what have you. And it was very lovely days. But I was saying to Mabel, my eldest, who's quite interested in media and audio production, that when I was editing sound, like audio for my degree, I used to have to sit for hours in an edit suite. You could book them overnight with a razor and white tape because it was all reel to reel. And the most technologically advanced it got was when the university department had a DAT recorder and you no longer had to work on it was crazy. It's like transferring from DAT from reel to reel and listening and playing it back and actually physically marking on and splicing it with the white tape. And it just seemed so long ago. So it's so important to kind of keep yourself up to date and keep upskilling and learning from young people and people who are newer into the field, because none of the technical skills I learned on that degree are any use now. It's so in the past. It's crazy.
What's the most surprising thing on your CV then, Sally?
Oh gosh. Now I'm processing. I'm going through like a timeline. I think it has to be a toss-up between working in a giant Yorkshire pudding takeaway in the Riding Shopping Centre in Wakefield, where we used to have to wear these ridiculous costumes, including a headpiece, like a hairnet in the shape of some Victorian chef. It was crazy. And working, when I did my master's, I was really, really broke. So I got a job working for Bass Taverns. They used to have a chain of bars called Flares.
Oh, yeah, like I remember 70s. You used to go to Flares in York.
Yep. And so when they first opened, they had like dance troupes, and you used to go along and they'd give you your regulation flared dungarees and a Cilla wig in lots of different neon shades. So you'd don your wig and your makeup and your dungarees, and when the cue song played, you'd get a little wink from the DJ, and then you had like 10 seconds to get onto the stage and do your highly sophisticated 1970s postmodern take on a dance routine, and then go back to glass collecting. So yeah, that was fun.
Random.
It was really random. It's one of those things on my CV that I kind of think, yeah, I could probably lose that now. It's really fun to include.
Yeah.
Oh, my CV is really short.
Well, you're younger than us, Alice. Don't rub it in.
I worked at a burger place, which was fun for a bit. But like I felt safe washing the pots, and so I'd like spend ages there.
Do you think jobs, like having a range of different job experiences, voluntary or not voluntary? I always think I draw from that now still. I still draw from that, like in the writing I'm doing at the moment, you know, just remembering little kind of rituals from that workplace, or the routines or the type of things customers would say in the retail experience I have. I do think there's a lot to be said for having had those experiences and being able to draw from that and just having that holistic view of people and, you know, what drives people to say the things and do the things they do, and what makes people happy, the tiny little joys that make people happy, you know, like the foods and, you know, the rituals of Friday nights. I think there's a lot to be said for a diverse CV.
There is. Working in pubs and clubs is definitely a great kind of ground for character development anyway, isn't it? I mean, there's lots of plays that are set in pubs and clubs and things, particularly northern plays, because there's more characters in northern pubs, let's be honest. Yeah. I'm sure there's plenty of characters down south. I'm only being biased.
Sally, so looking towards, I guess, the future, it's quite a broad question, sorry. What are your hopes for the future, and what would you like to see happen going forward?
I think from in the broader bubble, in the broader global sense, I'd really like to see people remember how much creativity and writing and literature has helped people grow and help people cope and help people survive and develop resilience during these times. I really would, because it has played a key role. It really, really has. You know, we talk about the Vera Lynns of the, you know, the wartime era, and we have far more access and diversity in the arts and literature that we have surrounding us, both on a free and paid basis. And I think for the future, I'd like people not to forget how creatives and writers and, you know, people with a broader vision have helped people hang on and see that future and keep connecting and developing and develop their resilience. That's a major thing for me, because it would be such a shame when you see everything that's being produced as a result of and to help people in these times. It would be such a shame if all that is forgotten and all this is lost. It really, really would. It's a really massive silver lining. It's an opportunity that's come from the adversity, and it's very important, I think, to remember that. I think in terms of a more personal point of view, but for me personally, we were just at the point for Calm Sea Creatives. We secured a space which was in quite a notable hall venue, And we're still kind of teetering on, will that happen or will that not happen? And it was so exciting, but obviously COVID happens and things slow down and the brakes get slammed on. But we're really excited to look towards getting a premises for Calm Sea Creatives and being able to connect with more work under the community interest company and charitable arm of the organisation. So we did a lovely project around Christmas where we got local people to share tips or little party tricks or stories on the run up to Christmas. And that was really lovely. So we're drawing together our allies and our friends to try and see where we can all have a place in creating opportunities for all sections of the community really in the future, so that we start to remove some of those barriers and hopefully some of the creative endeavours people have been introduced to during these times can find a way to continue and people can find a way to embrace that within their lives on a more permanent basis.
Oh no, that's really nice. I agree. It would be a complete shame if everything we've sort of been building on sort of got lost after. I do think a lot for, you know, children. It's like a really sort of important time, isn't it, for like the development of kids. Mm-hmm. And they've not had the opportunities. They're not seeing as many people as that they should be. They're not going out. They're sort of being like stuck at home. And it's like, you do sort of wonder about how the younger generation will be impacted.
Definitely. And I think talk and play. Talk, getting young people to talk about their experiences and play, so that all these things help them to process, you know. And each child and young person is different, and people talk about, you know, oh, you know, this person's been heroic during lockdown and these people are heroes, and great, we appreciate the nurses, the bin men, the retail people, the teachers, everybody who's had a role to play. But I think, you know, young people in particular, and also the vulnerable people who've been isolated on their own inside their homes, one of whom is my sister who has MS, she's been shielding. I think those people are heroes too. You know, they've just kind of got their heads down, accepted it and got on with that. And yeah, they'll have lost a year, perhaps, of certain aspects, not the whole of their schooling, but certain aspects of their schooling. But I think you're quite right. The broader implication is, you know, is that social connection and that opportunity for them to be given a means in which to express that, and be that through sport or music or dance or writing or experimentation, scientifically, creatively. I just think the focus now has to be on helping each other on the way out of this whole situation and making sure that we do emerge stronger and we do emerge knowing that we have people around us who care and can use those connections to continue to strengthen ourselves in the future.
Yeah. And my children at the moment, I think, don't really, I mean, they talk a little bit about the virus. If I say we can't do a certain thing, they'll say, oh, because of the virus. I don't think at the moment, or not that I can see as a notable change, that it's affected them socially or anything. Whereas I think potentially the younger kids, the kind of between like 1 and 2, where they are having that, it's a real developmental process of socially interacting with other children, interacting with other adults and all those things that I think is quite tricky. Well, you may see some issues, I think, for that kind of age group, maybe. Well, not issues, but they'll just be delayed in terms of those social abilities, I suppose, if they've been in those families that have literally just been at home and not been able to get them out and interact with other people for a long time. But, you know, again, creativity and that world that we talk about, it all stems from that, the child's mind, doesn't it? Creative people are generally also people that have kind of been able to stay youthful in one way or another and so have an imagination still. And unfortunately, lots of people lose their imagination if they end up not being able to use it. It's just a muscle, isn't it? The same as anything.
Absolutely.
And we're very privileged that we are allowed to use our imagination daily in what we do. But that imagination was with us as soon as we were born, and it was the most active when we were that age. So these kids, they're using that every day and probably inventing worlds upon worlds upon worlds anyway, and are very unaware of the fact that we're all locked in at home anyway.
There's always an outlet, isn't there? And it's ingenious. You know, we had a parcel delivered the other day and this box came through, my middle daughter's expecting some gymnastics equipment to practice indoors, and my younger daughter came running up even more excited. She's like, great, it's a box. I can make use of that. And off she trotted, and an hour later, you know, it's coloured in all sorts of felt tip pens and masking tape, and it's got all her dolls in it. And I think we can learn a lot from the resilience of young people and the resourcefulness as well. definitely.
I'll give you the slant that I would have had if a box came through. It would become flat within about 3 seconds. Stamp on. Oh, a box to flatten. We blew some balloons up yesterday for our Mexican party. And honestly, they lasted, I would say, literally as soon as I was blowing them up, they were getting popped. Bless them.
So, Sally, how can people find out more about you and what you're doing?
Great, definitely. If you check out the Calm Sea Creatives website, it's calmseacreatives.co.uk. That's fantastic. That would be really, really great. That'd be wonderful. We're trying to put some more things out there, and that's where we announce and launch all of our casting calls and project calls as well. Yeah, so get in touch.
Brilliant. Thank you, Sally. It was lovely having you on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. It was great to talk to you.
It really has been nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Other Chat. You can find out more about this podcast and platform through visiting our website at www.yada-yada-noise.com. You can also follow our social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all at yada-yada-noise.
Yada.